I'm Di Gillett, and this is the Power of Women podcast. We're a platform that showcases and celebrates the strength, resilience, and achievement of women from all walks of life. In each episode, I pose questions to my guests to peel away the layers to reveal the knowledge and the experience that shapes their narrative. So if you're feeling unseen, unheard, or simply looking for inspiration, then the Power of Women podcast is a great place to join the conversation. Just checking in, we've been going for quite a few episodes now. You can follow us on YouTube or on any of the major platforms. We'd love you to share and spread the word for the podcast. Now for today's guest. She's an entrepreneur. She developed her palate and interest in spirits as a bartender in London. She has a PhD in microbiology, and she says she's always been a feminist, even as a kid. Derv McGowan, welcome to the Power of Women podcast.
Thank you so much, Di.
Thank you.
It's lovely to be here.
Brilliant. Derv, where did you grow up?
I grew up in a stunning place in rural Ireland. So I was in a place called Sligo, and we were only 3 miles away from the town, but we were in sort of this idyllic sort of Enid Blyton-style childhood, and it was stunning, just one of the most beautiful places. I would go and visit places that were touristy, and I was told they were really, really stunning, and I was always slightly disappointed. And I realised later that it was because I lived in one of the most beautiful places on the planet.
And have you been back?
Yes.
Yeah. Gorgeous.
It's stunning. Yeah.
So what's the richest learning you've taken away from that childhood?
I was very fortunate to grow up with lots of stories of strong women, myths and legends, and even in, like, Ireland was Catholic, even in the Catholic faith there was saints that were, like, breaking rules all the time. Like, I'm not religious anymore, but we were surrounded by narratives of women that broke molds, and I remember there was the warrior queen Maeve, that we could see her grave from one of the hilltops where we were. You could look out and see a cairn, you know, a few miles away on another hilltop, another mountaintop. And then Grace O'Malley, which is a pirate queen from the 1600s. We grew up with stories from her.
So many fierce women out of Ireland.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And then we also had lots of strong women around us. Like, the women that I grew up with were farming community, and we just had to do what needed to be done when it needed to be done. So 4 o'clock in the morning, there were sheep or calves that, you know, lambs or calves that needed to be looked after. So there was this sort of resourcefulness around us as well.
That's really impactful. Love it. So let's start with a name, yours. Derv is an abbreviation of Davila.
Yes.
Tell us about Davila.
So I was called after and named after an ancient queen called Devagilia. And I was told she was an adulterous queen, which is, I thought, thanks. It was my father, so I said, thanks, Dad, that's great. I've sort of looked a little bit into the history of pagan religions in Ireland, pre-Christian religions, and queens often moved around fairly regularly between queens. Like Queen Maeve, for example, who I spoke about earlier, she was married to the Ulster king, and then at some point she moved to the Connacht king, and she was the daughter of the High King of Ireland. So there seems to have been some loss of story. So the Christian sort of lens put her as an adulteress. But
I was going to say, but that she might have just left an arsehole.
She might have left an arsehole, or perhaps the queen was a political position.
Yes.
Or there was a marriage there, and it wasn't about love and what we understand. It's a different proposition. And so it suggests that women had a more like a diplomatic role rather than just a wifely role in how we understand wifedom today. So I suspect what happened was there was some sort of political manoeuvre there. So that drew the two kings into war. So when she left one king for another, Devagilia drew the two kings into war. And then she's given the accolade of having the first time the British set foot in Ireland was as mercenaries in that war. However, it is clearly a woman getting blamed for a man's bad decisions in that moment, I think.
I'm going to have to do some research into Irish women and the history of Irish women, because there's absolutely a story there.
There really is. There's a whole lot of things. Like, if you look through the myths and legends of Ireland, you see these sort of stories of the warriors and the Fianna, who was the warrior class in Celtic times, and you hear stories about the queens and the kings and how they all interacted. But the male stories have been elevated, and the women's have been positioned as frivolous.
Troublemakers.
And troublemakers. Mm. And there's one amazing story about this young couple who were fleeing, and the young woman requests her partner to go and fetch a piece of fruit for her that she desperately needs. He has to break all sorts of rules to do this. It's sort of a little mini hero quest.
Mm.
But she obviously needed this piece of fruit. It was a magical piece of fruit. He had to slay a giant for it, all these things. And he got into trouble for it. There was something that happened to him for doing that. It was a sacrifice for him. But he had to get it for her. But the importance of this, if it was just a frivolous moment, why did he? And it was sort of saying that she manipulated him into getting it. But I suspect that it actually had some sort of spiritual significance, that she may have been a more important figure in the culture than she was given in the story. So there's overlays of Christianity and Western culture that has hidden some of those amazing stories about women in those cultures.
So how many Irish women proclaim feminists, I wonder? Do you know the answer to that?
I don't, but I would say a lot. Ireland
is... In your experience and growing up there, lots?
Well, because we were a farming community, there was... I don't know that it was prominent in our area. Women just got on with the jobs of
because you're working on the land.
Yeah, family,
toiling.
Community building. There was a lot of... We did a lot of community work. But Ireland, even though it's not given credence for it, is actually quite a progressive country. Even though in our referendums there was plenty of times when there was the options for divorce and abortion, they were rejected. But it was because the older generations were the ones who were voting.
Mm.
And as the younger generations have come through now, you see those progressive elements coming through. So it's an extraordinarily interesting country. And it's partially because of its pagan roots that actually came right the way through. Like, I grew up as a Catholic in Ireland, making sure never to take anything out of a fairy circle, because you would be in serious, like, trouble.
Right?
You'd get bad luck until you gave it back, and you'd have to give it back with a gift.
Mm.
Stories of people being taken away by the fairies or the Dedan, and there was all these other stories of, oaks have special significance over there. But it's not like we're sitting there going, you know, it's not this sort of, I don't know, it's sort of just in the culture. It's not, it's
back
just...
Back to your point of Enid Blyton setting and storytelling.
Yeah, it's glorious.
It's brilliant. Love it. So let's have a look at your entrepreneurial journey, because it's been an interesting one, and it spans two continents and lots of bars, as I understand it.
Indeed.
Then buckling down and completing a PhD in microbiology that would typically see you working in the field of research and science. That's not what happened. What's the abridged version of that story?
Well, I met my husband when I was 19 years old, Deacon in Geelong, and that's important because we sort of both ended up working in bars, and I was working in a nightclub, so it wasn't an elevated space, shall we say. But it was enormous fun, very fast pace, and I just really enjoyed customer service. I learned how to make cocktails, very basic cocktails there. But over time, I was sort of realised that I probably needed a little bit of a break from study. Part of the reason was I went to university, but I also went to a lot of parties. So I didn't finish my first attempt at a degree because I got very, very good at going to parties.
Yeah, there we go.
So I had enormous amounts of fun, but I realised that I probably needed to get that out of my system. So I ended up going over to London. Well, I went to Dublin and spent a little bit of time there, and then joined my husband, well, my husband-to-be at that point in London. And we spent an enormous amount of time, like we both worked in cocktail bars, but we spent a lot of time learning about flavour and taste, and we had planned to go travelling, but we spent every penny on food and drink and experiencing London, and it would have looked very frivolous.
I was going to say.
Yes.
Yeah, I bet Mum and Dad thought it was incredibly frivolous.
Mum and Dad didn't know much about what was going on.
You were researching.
Yes,
scientific
that's right.
research.
Scientific research for my future career.
Yeah.
But I eventually sort of got to the point where I wanted to go back and study. And so we relocated to Australia. And Seb immediately got a job at the gym. Oh, no, Gin Palace was where he first worked, and that's obviously an institution.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so he worked in amazing bars in London, as did I. Importantly, while we were there, we worked with Dick Bradsall and Wayne Collins, who were involved in the renaissance of cocktail culture again, and that was in the late 90s, early 2000s. So that was an extraordinary experience to be part of that, and I think that's why we sort of got stuck in London. It's because we were part of this cultural shift. Mm. Moving from, you know, basic drinks into exquisite cocktails. And I developed my love of the Negroni there and my love of the martini there. You know, someone from Ballarat and Geelong heading to London, then sipping on martinis in some of the best bars in the world.
It was
extraordinary.
Exotic.
Yeah, it was. And it was just a delight to be part of making some of those cocktails, like sipping, going in with Wayne Collins and sitting at a bar and sort of him saying, what do you think of this and what should I do with this? Because he was one of those guys who was really open to anyone who wanted to, you know, take part in his journey, and he was passionate about cocktails. So Seb worked extensively with him and we hung out a little bit. And, yeah, it was just extraordinary to be part of that. But as I said, I got sort of to the point where I wanted to return to study and went back and studied at Monash and just sort of followed my nose through to a PhD. Loved science, still do love science, but I had quite a difficult PhD and it sort of, I got to the end of it and I just sort of didn't want to do it anymore, which was really sad because I really felt like that's where I wanted to be. And it took me nearly 6 months to realise that because I had sort of incorporated the PhD into my identity in a lot of ways. And when you go through an academic sort of stream, you get to the end and the academics are like, the only thing you can do is academia. They sort of don't mention industry or they don't mention going and doing other things. So I realised that probably science wasn't for me when I was applying for jobs and I started to feel sick. And it took a little while to actually realise that I didn't want to do it. And so my body was telling me, and also, you know, intellectually, I sort of knew. So I cast about and I went and did some work with food waste recycling with a little startup there, which was absolutely amazing. I sort of rekindled my love of science. I was looking at soil microbiology and how that all works.
It's not that far afield.
No. So I was a medical microbiologist. I looked at soil microbiology, which was really not, there was not much known about it at the time. So it was a very exciting time to be part of that. So that was all sort of going along, and I was teaching a little bit at Monash as well. And then I also had a child in that time. And then Seb himself was working at a big liquor company. So this is sort of talking about our sort of foray into where we got to just before we hit the distillation sort of element.
Yeah.
But Seb himself was not very happy with where he was at either. And then there was an opportunity for us to look at potentially shifting completely into another field.
There you go. And you actually did a Google search, which I do to answer so many things these days. And I think, you know, we diagnose illness and all sorts of things by self-searching on Google. But you actually asked Google, you said, I did a PhD, now what?
Yeah.
Did Google have an answer for you?
It did. Well, I was sort of desperate at that point. I knew I didn't want to be a research scientist anymore. And I was just thought, oh, stuff it, I'll just see what Google says. And so there was actually an article which was written in America, which was basically almost the same title as the Google search.
Mm.
And one of the most important things that I took from that article was write down what you love and write down what you didn't love about your PhD. So that was one thing. And the other thing was...
That's career advice that I give. You do a left-hand column and a right-hand column, and it becomes very apparent when you put it down on paper.
It does, yeah. Mm. It was amazing. And the other thing they said was, you have a PhD and you've been told you're amazing, but you're not. You actually have to work out what your skill sets are. Are you useful to an employer? And that was, like, I hadn't actually realised that.
That's
I thought I was all that.
Against the glass stuff.
Yeah, and you really do think you are all that after you finished a PhD.
I'm smart.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, I realise that PhDs aren't about being smart. They're just about being persistent.
Yeah,
and persevering. Because I wasn't the smartest cookie in my cohort, but I finished.
Mm.
So what I realised when I did my two little lists was the things that I enjoyed about my PhD was not so much the science. What it was collaboration and talking to other people about their work and getting excited about their work.
That's fascinating, because the PhD is all about core skills and you've learnt the soft skills out of it.
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I brought to it. I started a student association there I restarted it. It had lapsed and that's still going. And that was in 2007 or 2008,
I think. That's the Irish Queen coming out.
I need to have a drink on Fridays, right? So I'm going to orchestrate something that allows for that to occur.
Yeah.
So that's what I sort of realised I actually needed. I didn't really love the bench work. I loved the interaction with other people and communication. And I'm also really good at problem solving. Mm. So I can have, if you can explain to me your problem, I don't need to have a deep knowledge of that problem. I'll be able to find a solution to it. And I'm also someone who will never give up. If someone gives me something to do, I've always been able to find a solution to a problem. Yeah, because I just won't stop.
Mm.
And that's that was something I didn't quite realise until...
Tenacity in spades.
Yeah, and it was after my PhD that I realised, you know, that was there, and that tenacity was something that was, like, core to who I am. Mm. And I hate the word no, you can't.
Yeah.
It's an instant fire.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, let me show you how I can.
Yeah, yeah. No, we might get on well over a drink d'oeuvre, I guess, because there's lots in what you've just said there that I totally relate to.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So you launched your own business with your husband, Sebastian, or Seb, in 2016, Anthea Distillery in Geelong in Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
What's the story behind Anthea?
So Anthea began its life in other people's businesses in a way. So when Seb and I sort of hit this sort of dissatisfaction with our careers at the same time, which I think is fortunate. It could be a not a great situation for other people.
Yeah, but growing together, very fortunate.
And a friend of ours, Cam Smith from Triple R, actually knew someone who needed a distiller. Now, back in 2016, there were no distillers around because we had a fledgling industry. Four Pillars had just started. So if you sort of thought you might be able to distill, people would take you on.
Mm.
So we worked at Craft & Co. Craft & Co. is a space that has a brewery, a distillery, and it had cheese making. So it was a little sort of creator's hub. It's a really beautiful spot in Smith
Where's
Street.
Where is that? Smith Street in Collingwood,
Collingwood,
of course.
Yeah.
Yes.
They have this beautiful 150-litre Carl still. It's stunning copper.
And they are beautiful-looking things.
Oh, they're divine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they just look steampunk, sort of like Victorian-esque.
Yeah, they're like a work of art.
Yeah, they're just gorgeous. So Seb was offered the job 3 days a week. So he went from a six-figure salary to a hourly production wage, which is very little money.
Mm.
And he was getting that for 3 days a week, and we actually negotiated time on the still to play and see if we wanted to make some gin and wanted to do our own brand. So in lieu of...
Yes, of a real salary.
Sort of wage. And I was working as a consultant, scientific consultant, and I was also doing some teaching at Monash to sort of... We were to make ends meet. And mind you, we had a four-year-old child at the time who was just starting school.
So you're taking a real leap of faith in this.
We were, but it didn't feel like that. Like, I think if someone told me our story, I would sit there thinking, this is crazy, you're nuts. Like, I don't think I could do that. But we did do that. So it's interesting when you live
it. Living proof.
Yeah, when you live it and when you hear it, they're very different. So we also had a mortgage. So we were taking a very big risk. But there was a lot of things in place that were keeping us secure in our minds. And
you knew it was gin? It's going to be gin?
We knew it was going to be gin.
Yeah. Why?
It's quick and easy to make in one sense, like relative to some of the other spirits, but we love gin. Like, I love gin.
Quite partial to it myself.
So, like, it's no surprise that the Negroni and the Martini were my favourites, and they're big cocktails. Like, they're the big, big cocktails. Huge flavour. And our gin is very cool because it can reflect any region. So in Australia...
It tells a story.
Yes, you can tell a story about anything you want through plants. And in Australia we have huge numbers of botanicals that we can use in gin. So in Australia we have 22,000 potential plants that we can use in distillation.
That's extraordinary.
Amazing. The equivalent number in Europe is 1,400. Not 14,000, 1,400. And I remember
that when I... That sets up an enormous commercial opportunity.
It does. And it also reflects the huge bounty that we have in Australia that we've been ignoring since settlement. And I think that for me, gin is another way of us to sort of subverting the narrative of the European narrative and actually gently introducing the indigenous bounty that we have here. And it's such a beautiful... The plants are just extraordinary that we have in Australia. They're as weird and wonderful as our animals. So for me, it's a really great opportunity. So that came later. That realization came later. But we did gin.
You're right,
we love
in the
gin.
Heart of it now.
Yeah, absolutely. I adore it. Gin is hard to... It's hard to make a good recipe, but once you make a good recipe, then things flow beautifully from it. And we sort of just, you know, the piece of equipment we were working on is $150,000 worth. So it's extraordinary that we were let in to do it.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Like,
it's an because you're testing on somebody's investment.
Yes. And they were quite happy. We were very careful. We loved it. And although I wasn't being... paid, Seb and I sort of spent a lot of time together trying to work out what this gorgeous piece of machinery could do and would do. And
you set up your own apprenticeship in essence.
We did, which was amazing. The first bit was to try and work out how to distill. I had so much fun. I fell in love with it straight away. Interestingly, before I saw the still, I was very reticent. Seb was like, let's start this business. And he'd already seen the still. He'd already, he was really impressed with it and was excited. And I was saying, no, we need to see if it stacks up. There's no way. We've got to look at, I didn't know what I was talking about.
Well, you're a left brain, yeah.
Oh, well, I don't know. I think I was just a bit scared. And so I was sort of putting the brakes on, and he said, just come and have a look at the still. And I'm like, no, we'll do these numbers first.
He knew you'd fall in love with it.
I sort of did, and then I saw it, and it was literally love at first sight. That was it, business plan out the window. I just wanted to play on this thing. It was just gone. It was just amazing.
Wow, incredible.
And so over the next couple of years, we were able to cut our teeth on how to make a good spirit, how to build a brand. Seb had done work with 42 Below, so amazing brands, 666 Vodka. And so he'd done some great work with that. So he'd enjoyed being a brand ambassador for them and looking at, you know, their strategies and how they worked. So that was great. And then we also had to work out whether we were any good at business. And we were okay at business at
the
start.
But you sound like the two of you are a great complement of skills.
We are, yeah.
So.
Yeah. And his bartending, he was hilarious because he would bring home, like, we would do tandem distillations on when we were working out our recipe for our fresh gin, the Australian Dry. We would do all of our experiments on this, I think it was a 2-litre little pot still, tiny little thing, gorgeous. And I would be doing things and writing things like science, right? So the scientific method was well in play. And so Seb and I had some creative differences around that. Because he was a bartender and he'd put up his cocktail on the bar and it didn't taste right. So he'd change sugar or put a bit of acid in or, you know, he'd do it on the fly. But you can't do that with a gin because you make the gin, it needs, when it comes off the still first, it doesn't taste how it will taste.
The so flavour develops.
So it needs to rest for 1 to 2 weeks before you can actually really taste what the gin will do, because all those bright, nice, citrusy notes are all prominent. They're prominent at the start. Things, the softness of the juniper and the soft spice are hidden away under all of those volatiles. So it just needs time to rest and integrate. And so we learned about that in the first week or two of playing around. But he still had his bartender thing where he wanted to change. So he came home and he thought he'd changed 3 things and he'd actually changed 5 things when he'd done one of his distillations. And I was like, no, you've got to do the scientific method. We have to change 1 thing at a time and then wait.
And see what that does.
Take our notes and do the next thing. And he says, yeah, but I don't want to wait. I know what needs to change. And I said, I know you do, but if we change more than 1 thing at a time...
We won't know which part was positive and which was negative.
That's right. Yep. Anyway, the other problem with Seb, or the amazing thing about Seb, is he's got this ability to ask things in. So he can sometimes do an amazing recipe and just throw stuff together and it'll be perfect. Like, he does that really well. And I was really hoping...
What's that phrase you use? Ask things in.
Yeah, ask it in.
Ask you. Yeah, got it. I remember that.
Yeah. And so I was really worried he'd do that. But thankfully he didn't. Yeah. What he did was really bad. It was a really bad distillation. So it was a good lesson for him.
Yeah.
And
You
can't always ask things in, especially with distillation, because you're dealing with so many different things. That was some of the fun And it was just like this movement of how do we work together and as a partnership. And we actually worked really, really well together, which was a relief.
Still married.
Still married, happily married. And yeah. I will definitely say gin does wonderful things for your marriage.
Yeah.
And so we stayed at Craft & Co. until we outgrew Craft & Co. and then moved on to Brogan's Way in Richmond, which is another stunning family-run distillery, father-daughter pairing there.
And then when did Anther come out the gate? What year?
So we came out the... So we left... So we were a brand that whole time. So Anther was a brand the whole time.
Yeah.
And then we moved to Geelong...
In your own right.
In our own right. We as a family moved in 2018. All the planning was done through 2018 and 2019. I think you know where I'm going here.
I do think
you're planning to open
timing.
In 2020. and we built in 2020 and opened at a little bit later in 2020. So we actually, as an independent business, have never had an ordinary year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And ironically, I'd had no intentions of having two guests that are in this distilling space in such a close period of time, but circumstances led to that.
Yeah.
And my other guest, they're a whiskey distiller, and they opened their business in 2019, five months before the world changed.
Yeah.
So ironic in that. One thing I was going to ask you, wine tasting, taste, spit it out. What do you do with gin?
Well, I drink it.
Of course you do.
when we do tastings, you're taking in such a small amount. So when you're taking in tastings, I
what's the alcoholic proof level of gin?
So it can vary between 37-38%.
Yeah,
to
so a little more than wine. So
57%.
You're drinking a little amount, but it's got some punch.
But for me as a distiller,
pardon the pun.
Yeah, it does definitely, and it makes a great punch.
Yeah.
There's a particular way of tasting spirits. So you're employing, like wine, you're employing all of your senses. But with spirits, if you breathe in too soon, you'll actually cough because the evaporation of the ethanol or the alcohol on your tongue will actually go into
I've experienced that with home-brewed Polish spirit, which is, like almost 100% proof that evaporates about this far out from you, from your mouth.
Yeah. And, I mean, sometimes I taste off the still at about 89%. Alcohol, so that comes off the still high, and still sometimes get caught out if I breathe in like too soon in the wrong spot. So you sort of have to sip it and let it sit on your tongue, and swallow, and then breathe. Allow your sense of smell to breathe in and out, and just allow the evaporative. The evaporated vapor to sort of move into your sinus, and then you just get this. It just sits around in your mouth and nose, and it's just beautiful.
And you make it such a romantic thing.
as long as you don't breathe in at the wrong point.
Yeah. So coming up, we're going to add some feminine energy to our discussion.
The Power of Women podcast with Di Gillett.
So the distilling sector in Australia, much like many other countries, has historically been male-dominated, and women still represent a minority in the sector when compared to men. Their growing presence and influence, though, is steadily growing. Tell us about what role you've played in moving the needle, and I bet you have played a role.
I've always wanted to elevate women everywhere I've worked and develop women.
Well done.
And I've always been, like I think you said earlier, a pretty rabid feminist and very proud of it and known for it. So in our industry, we've got an interesting split. A lot of the businesses in Australia are run by families, and the men tend to be the distillers and the women tend to run the business.
Doctors and nurses.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And the men get the glory and the women get not a lot of attention. So we have, I'm a distiller and I run the business. So I see every of it.
Seb's not a distiller.
Well,
he is.
He just doesn't, he hasn't worked in our business. So he worked for a different company for a few years. So I ran Anther and have run Anther for the last 3 to 4 years. So I do the production and I do all, I sort of do everything. Mm. So we have a cellador, we do production, so I do spirits development and work with our collaborations. And I have an amazing group of women that have worked with me and continue to work with me, and some men as well. So we have run the business with only women in it, but it's also great to have men. I enjoy having, I believe, in balance and equity. And we need men. Men are important in our lives, and they're important allies. And you know, where we live
and
in a society.
Hit bang on. It's equality and allies.
Yes.
It's not an us and them.
No way.
Yeah.
And the men that are in my life have always been supportive. And I think when I was younger, I was quite combative. But now I understand.
Surprised by you saying that, Dirk. I mean, that is just. Out of the blue.
But as I've gotten older, I don't see it as a valuable thing for me.
To be combative.
Yeah. There's a time and place.
Mm.
But holding the line is far more important and holding it in a calm way. And I think that's...
That's your Irish roots.
Yeah, yes.
It really is.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. So in our industry, I belong to a group called Australian Women of Distillation. And
how many members in that?
There's it's a very young organisation, but we have quite a few people. We've got a couple of hundred people that attend, considering we've got a fairly small industry.
Mm.
What that organisation does is it mentors people. We have networking events, which I don't like the word networking because it's sterile.
Yeah.
I love Julie Gillard's approach to networking, which she says it's actually friendships and acquaintances you're making, not...
Mm.
It's because network sounds so like you're using
sterile.
People.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So these are not your average networking events. So
no, because there's alcohol involved.
There's alcohol involved. And we talk about women in the industry.
Mm.
We talk about our journeys and give advice.
Mm. And is there commonality in those journeys of what the challenges and pushback has been?
Yeah, there is. One of the things that, you know, commonly happens around in committees, so as you progress through your career, you join committees and you advisory groups, and one of the common things that happens with women is you are around a table with a large group and you come up with an idea and you don't get, people just ignore you. Mm. It's what you have said has been ignored.
Mm.
And so giving advice on and how to manage those sorts of times. So if you see that happening to a woman, you call that out and say, hang on, what did...
Echoes the same in the boardroom.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then I had one experience where I put forward an idea. It was on the agenda of the meeting. I put forward an idea. I spoke about it. And there was not a sound in the room. Like, nobody said anything. And then they moved on before...
Didn't even acknowledge it.
It was acknowledged. Thanks. Thank you for that, Dev. And we'll move on. And
dismissed, worse.
Yeah, yeah. And so I just waited till the end of the meeting when there was the other business. Is there any other business? Well, actually, yes, there is.
We didn't attend to. You just moved on from mine, yeah.
I just said I'd just like to bring that up again, and I really would like some feedback. I don't mind whether it's negative or positive. I'd just like some. And so the feedback was given and we moved on, but...
This is where the reputation builds.
Yes.
You're renowned for it.
Yes.
Yep.
And so,
well done.
But there's other younger women on that committee that saw me do that and now have that lesson for themselves.
Mm.
So that for me is acting in an open way that other women can learn from it. So that's where I try to sort of... They're the sorts of things we talk about at our events. And, we give access to women, to older women that have been through some of these things.
Yeah.
And some of the younger women, like I remember when I was in my early 20s, I hadn't encountered the misogyny that you get as you get older and you start to progress. When you're not a threat and you're a young woman and you're not a threat.
Yeah, you don't experience
it.
Yeah,
and it just starts to come later. And I think having those conversations with young women now so that they can go, oh,
it's not such a surprise, this is what she did.
Yes, and I'm not on my own because it is very isolating when
you hit
those.
That's exactly why we sit around and do these podcasts, for exactly that reason.
Yeah. It's so important.
Yeah.
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 So
I think
important.
I said to you, mentoring through storytelling, and this is how you do it. So how do you hold your steel when times are tough? And times certainly would have been tough launching your own business in 2019.
There's lots of different ways that I do it, but one of the things that I have to, that I tell myself, I know in my heart and my soul deep, is that things are tough now, but they're not always going to be tough. But they could get tougher or they could get better.
Yep.
But they're not always going to be super tough. There'll be rest periods. And so that tenacity that I learned during my PhD, so when you do a PhD, you 90% of the time is failure and 10% of the time is moderate success and probably 0.1% of the time is exquisite success.
Exercise in tenacity.
Yeah, so getting up, so being pushed over, I don't tend to fall over, I'll take a push and then I'll sit and think, but I will give myself space to stop because that was something I used to do. I used to respond and react a lot. So instead of considering what why I am having the hard time or what it is, I'll react and I'll say, I'll have an idea and I'll go and go into fix mode straight away rather than being considered. So I had to learn that one pretty quickly.
So we don't really mellow with age. We've just got more wisdom and more experiences to draw on.
Yes.
To react more appropriately as we get older.
Yeah. And I think you get more patient. Weirdly, you get more and less patient.
I was going to say, haven't quite felt the patience come in yet, and I know I'm older than you, Dev, but maybe I'm a late bloomer.
I don't know. I think I got more strategic as I got older, and I realised that waiting was important. Don't act too quickly. Mm. And also, there's not just one reason something happens.
Of course.
So when COVID happened, we lost 80% of our business overnight because we were focused on bars and restaurants. And it was very scary for us because we just you know, put a lot of time and effort into building a distillery. Mm. And I swore that I'd never be as exposed again. So I developed a business that had, like, and this was the plan anyway, but a cellar door, website sales, retail sales, and
diversity
bar sales, but also a contracting wing for our business as well. So we do...
So B2B and B2C in your strategy.
Yeah, yep. But different, because a lot of that first bit that I spoke to you about was retail, wholesale, cellar door are all actually dependent on one another.
Yes.
If times are good in society, you're going to do really well in expensive luxury sales, because our gin is a luxury item at $80 plus a bottle.
Yeah.
So I needed something else to bolster us in case that fell over again. And so what we did was there's the contract distillation. So we make booze for other people and we find ways of making booze for other people and tell them.
So is that a white labelling strategy?
White labelling, but also there's products that we will make the base spirit for, and that will go into a cocktail maker's product. And because we've been around so long, we've got a skill set as well. So so Seb is, he's got this amazing brain where he can take something from our size, and we're a tiny business, we've kept ourselves small, so maybe two people working in the business, and if there's investment, he's able to scale it within a year to 2 years to something big. And so that skill set's very valuable at the moment. And then going out and consulting and teaching, and so that's, we've actually
nimble.
Just been broadening our business, because we've had to. And so at the moment, and it's coming back to what I was saying, at the moment our retail wholesale has shrunk.
Of course.
And so, but we're seeing a
because your discretionary spend in a tough economic setting.
Yeah, and you almost feel like bad trying to advertise to people to buy something that they can't afford at the moment. And so because of that, we're not as heavily dependent on that side of our business anymore. We've got our contract and consulting arm that we're doing quite okay, and it's helping us through this tough period.
Yeah.
So for us, there's that element too.
Yeah. So do you have a mentor?
I don't. I think I've got that's the other thing. I think this is the Irish culture. There's the power imbalance. I don't like it.
You feel inventor might tell you what to do. Is that what it is?
I do. It just feels weird to me. Like a mentor feels weird. And I was asked to be a mentor and I felt weird as well. Like I'm happy to talk.
But you've got people that you look up to. You talked about, you know, the iconic names in London. So, you know, informal mentoring or people that you aspire and admire.
Yeah, and I honestly think that's been not great for my career, because I don't want that whatever that relationship is, I've got some sort of a thing in my hindbrain about it.
Don't forget, a mentor doesn't have to be within your industry.
That's
mentor
right.
can be completely left of field.
Yeah, yeah. I do have people I look up to, and I do have people I talk to. Kathleen Davies, who I work with, she's in our industry. She's great because we can talk frankly about our businesses. But that's a friend of mine. But also that's how I think that's what a mentor should be, but it isn't that. It's not supposed to be a friend. But and then there's amazing young people like Brogan at Brogan's Way, who's doing a PhD in Australian botanicals and flavours, and and she's amazing as well. So there's so many women that and men that I have great conversations with and talk to. Dave at Patient Wolf as well. He's been amazing.
Oh,
Dave,
there's an informal list there.
Yeah, so there is this people that I really get a lot out of conversations with. But it's an interesting thing. I've got a weird relationship with that sort of.
So what have you learned about yourself? If you reflect back on the journey you've been on, what's been the richest learning that you've learned about you?
I think I'm pretty good.
I think you are pretty good.
My thing is like that I'm brilliant. Like I had a friend who said, we're going, you know, through life, where your best friend says, and she goes, how are you? And she said, how are you doing all this? And I said, because I'm brilliant.
But you believe in yourself.
Yeah, but I don't, it's quite a solid comfort and confidence. that I just...
You're not an arrogant person. I'm sitting here across the table from somebody who's engaging and forthright, but I'm not sitting here across the table from somebody who's arrogant because they think they're brilliant.
So. No, but I just look at what we've achieved and I'm really proud of it.
You
and
should
I think
be.
That's what it is. Mm. I enjoy it and I feel very lucky, but I also will always try to find joy no matter where I am. Like if I'm up to my knees and was in cow dung, shoveling it out of my uncle's cow shed because he was too unwell, I still find joy in that moment. Mm. So that's, I think, sort of who I am a little bit as well. I'm lucky to have that disposition.
Yeah. Which leads me to one of my closing questions then, Derv. What is a phrase that defines you?
I think it's tenacity and finding joy wherever you are. So it's not really a phrase, I suppose.
Well, it's a state of mind.
Mm. Yeah. I think for me as well, there's a huge amount in community and collaboration as well. So it's that, and I think you can find joy if you can look around your life and see that there's good things there and there's good relationships there. So, yeah, I think the community and joy and tenacity.
Mm. Yeah. Glass half full.
Mm.
So if you were to pay forward all the wisdom and knowledge you've amassed from your lived experience thus far, what would be the salient point you'd pass on to someone else?
I think it's all about persistence and tenacity. And just know that most people are faking their confidence.
Mm.
That's, if I'd known that when I was younger...
Their feet are peddling under the surface, yeah, just like yours are.
Yeah. So if someone brings me a problem, I don't know how to fix it, but I'll just work it out as I go.
Mm.
There's some problems I've seen before, and it looks so easy if you've seen a problem before to fix a problem. But I think understanding that that what you as a person, you have something valuable to bring, mm-hmm. and it could be new, fresh eyes. Like any time anyone comes into our business, I just say, I'm going to train you and induct you into our business. I want you to tell me what's wrong. Mm. I want you to see how we can improve, because those fresh eyes will never be as fresh again, because they'll get used to us and they'll get comfortable. But that first few weeks,
yep.
that's a really valuable time where you can refresh things. So that is valuable. Not knowing things is so valuable.
Mm.
So coming to a group of experienced people with no knowledge of or little knowledge.
No preconceived ideas.
That's a really valuable thing, and
it
should
is.
Be confident within that. And that should be valued and elevated as you enter into that place. So, yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for coming up from Geelong to join us today in the studio. It's been so insightful. I'm sitting here across the table from a truly fierce Irish woman, without a doubt. How do people reach out and purchase Anthet? Elevator pitch for the business.
So we are a gorgeous small distillery in North Geelong. We have our still is actually in the cellar door space, so you'll see everything there.
Okay.
Everything is handmade.
Wow.
From start to finish, we even put the labels on by hand. And you can find us in the Federal Mills in North Geelong, Federal Woolen Mills. It's an old red brick factory.
Mm, it's I so do know where that
beautiful.
Is from growing
so,
up down there.
Yes.
Yeah?
It's a beautiful historical building, but it's also been renewed by the current developers there, the Hamilton Group, and they've just made it beautifully green and just... honoured the site and just sort of made it beautiful. And then our business, it's on Instagram, is Anthet Spirits.
Yes.
And so we try to sort of, you'll see that lots of collaborations on there and interesting little things we do behind the scenes. I have one where I, arrive in the morning, 4 o'clock or whatever time I start at distillation.
Oh, wow.
And walk you through. So we have little snippets of that. And how we make our gin, and we do really fun events. We do lots of women-focused events as well, so Women's Health Week in September, we've got a few events.
Fantastic.
And fundraisers. So, yeah, we like to collaborate and have, give a little bit back. I can't just do a business. I have to give a little bit back. So we try to fundraise and work with local community schools and football clubs and all sorts.
Yeah. Fantastic. Mm. So if you've enjoyed this episode of the podcast, please be sure to share it with somebody else. And Derv's story and the adversity of starting a business at such a difficult time and coming out the other end with such determination has to be inspiration for somebody else, indeed. You can follow me on the socials on LinkedIn, Instagram and Facebook. And you might like to jump on to my website, powerofwomen.com.au, if you've got a guest or a suggestion of a topic that you'd like to pursue. And that's how Derv and I have come to be sitting here, was she did, a member of her team did exactly just that. So it's an opportunity to showcase and identify fantastic, inspiring stories. Until next time.